Chris and Jim, it's the first time I'm interviewing two people at the same time, but it's a very hard and difficult subject, a very controversial subject, which lots of people have been talking about, and that is the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull. And so I would like to welcome Chris Winter and Jim Horney. Now, Chris, you are the culprit of dragging me further and further into the Mitchell Hedges debate. But what got you involved with the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull?
Back in about 1989, I was very much into things of an esoteric value. And one night I just had a dream about a skull. But it was one of these dreams that appeared to be more real than the normal dream, as if I was touching it, I was talking to it, it was alive, it had all the things that normally one doesn't associate with dreams. And in the morning, when I woke up, I was so taken aback by this feeling, this dream I had, that I decided to investigate if it was actually real. So by speaking to various people, and at this time, I think Kindred Spirit sort of magazine, I think, was just about starting. There were a few New Age magazines going around. I discovered a chap who, in Livingston Downs, who had a video called, a meditation video called Into the Crystal Skulls. And I purchased that, and lo and behold, onto it was the skull, I think, that I associated with. In my business career, I had just given up my work and decided to go around the world and sort of go around looking at ancient cultures and things like that, and made a stab at to try and find out where the person who owned the crystal skull lived. And through a series of investigations, I found that her name was Anna Mitchell Hedges. She lived in Kitchener in Canada, and I had an address. And so what I did was to write to her. Now, I didn't actually hear from her for some time. 2 weeks just before I was about to go on my trip around the world, I had a letter from her that basically said, "Dear Chris, I would love to see you. Please call me when you get to Canada." So I had to make sort of rearrangements and fly into Toronto. And that's where I first met Anna. I went out one afternoon, arrived at the doorstep. She greeted me with her usual wonderful smile, and said, "My word, what a lucky boy you are." And not realizing what she actually meant, she explained it to say, well, normally today is the day that people, it's an open house and people come and sit and meditate with the skull. And you just happen to be the only one. So that was my introduction.
And Jim, I believe you didn't have to fly across half the world to meet Anna.
No, I actually lived in Kitchener. At that point in time, I used to get together about one evening a week with a good buddy of mine from work, and we'd compare notes on books we'd been reading and magazines and whatnot on strange things going on in the world and strange things from the past. And I happened to have a National Geographic with me one time that I picked up and showed him, and the picture on the cover was of this carved head. And I said, "What do you think of this?" It was just a normal-looking face in the carving, and they had carbon-dated it to over 100,000 years old. I said, "So they think we're over 100,000 years old." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, that's pretty neat, but have you ever heard of this thing called the crystal skull?" And of course, which I hadn't. "It appears in libraries around here from time to time." And it wasn't more than a couple of weeks later, I was wandering through one of the local bookstores and saw a book called Mysterious Canada. So I picked it off the shelf and said, "Well, just for the heck of it, let's see what's in Kitchener." And lo and behold, there was a picture of the crystal skull with Anna's name. And, geez, I wonder if she's in the phone book. Opened up the phone book. Sure enough, she's in there. So we dialed her up and said, "You know, would you mind if we popped over and had a chat one evening?" And she said, "Absolutely not. Come on over anytime." So we set an appointment. A friend and my older brother and myself dropped in and visited Anna. We each bought a copy of The Skull Speaks and went on our merry way, and figuring that was probably the end of it. A couple of years later, I had picked up my first book by David Hatchard, Childress, Lost Cities of North and Central America, and I took it into my chiropractor's office one day, and he took a look at it and says, "Oh boy, you'd really like to meet this one patient of mine." And guess who it was? And I said, "Wait a minute, I thought she was in England." "Well, no, she moved back a couple of months ago." So needless to say, I opened the phone book again and got back in touch with her, and my son and I went over to visit her. She was kind of in a lonely state at the time because Cynthia had passed away and her last little puppy had passed away. So she seemed to be pretty much on her own, and seemed to enjoy the company. But nonetheless, I thought, well, maybe we better give her a break 1 week, and we didn't go, and the next thing I know, the phone's ringing to find out where we were. So it kind of became a weekly routine, and things grew out of that.
Anna lived until the age of 100, and she obviously was the daughter of Mike Mitchell Hedges, the person who has the honor of having his name attached to the Crystal Skull. What kind of role, what kind of place in Anna's daily routine and daily life did the skull have?
I would say, as far as Anna goes, the skull was pretty much the focal point of her life in those days. It brought in new friends pretty much every single day. It wasn't too long after we started visiting her regularly. In fact, and by the end of October of 94, things had changed immensely in my life to the point where I was suddenly free to do all the things I wanted to do. Anna kind of took me in at that point in time, and I moved into her basement and began the work on the reprinting of her dad's book.
The infamous Danger, My Ally. One of the interesting aspects of the Crystal Skull is that Mitchell Hedges referred to it in the UK edition, but left it out in the US edition. I assume in your years of research, both Chris and Jim, that you've come across these aspects and have tried to investigate and tried to come up with answers there as well.
That one's actually a very simple one. There's a letter within the Mitchell Hedges archives, I believe in Bill's possession, that actually comes from the American publisher saying that they will agree to print the book in the U.S. if they can take out that chapter because they felt that it had absolutely no relevance to the book. So it was not Mr. Mitchell Hedges' idea whatsoever.
So it meant that that you had one UK edition where the skull was mentioned,
yeah.
But a U.S. edition where the skull wasn't mentioned. But that mention of the Crystal Skull itself is very intriguing because Mitchell Hedges points out that he has got this skull, he's traveling to it to Africa, but that he will never say how he got it into his possession. And Anna points out in her statements that she found the skull in Lubantum. So the question then is, was Mitchell Hedges referring to the same revelation, or was there more to it?
As far as my research has shown, I have only come across one document out of thousands that quotes, it's a newspaper document that quotes Mr. Mitchell Hedges as saying it came from Lubantum. However, being very familiar with how newspaper reporters and documentary workers and all this work, I have no doubt that it was probably Anna that said that. And they wrote it down and attributed it to Mr. Mitchell Hedges, and that was out of a South African newspaper. Other than that, as he says in Danger, My Ally, how it came to be in my possession, I have reason for not revealing.
Chris, you were the one who put me on the trail, so I guess it's only right for you to kind of explain what that mention led you to, and it's also something, it's a direction, which was also picked up by the people who created Indiana Jones, because it involves the name Panchavia. It's a very bizarre reference in the movie.
The one sentence that always intrigued me, and I think, you know, both Jim and I would most probably feel this, is that he says, how it came to my possession, I have reason for not revealing. And I thought that's very strange, because it's all documented that he actually bought it and the 1943 auction sale, and it was in his possession. So it's not that we didn't know where it came from. We do know where it came from. But why would he say, this is the question, why would he say, I have reasons for not revealing, if he didn't actually want you to look closer into something? It's that particular thing that started to lead me to believe there was something more to it, that perhaps he did have it in his possession. I mean, Anna has always said about this, is that in the case of Sidney Burney, which is where it was put into auction as part of his collection, and Anna said that her father knew Sidney Burney, and it was quite normal for those days for them to kind of shed their bits and pieces through friends whilst they sold up and went on an expedition. And they said, we'll pick it up when we come back. But in this particular case, I think Mitchell Hedges was raising money for his expedition. I mean, this is according to Anna, I have to say. There's no documents to say that this is true. So we just go along that line. But the thing that has always been with me is this link of going back. And it was Sidney Morell's book, Ambrose Bierce, F.A. Mitchell Hedges and the Crystal Skull, which is the thing that really started to open up various ideas. And that we now know, which is what we have discussed, is that in 1913, Jim, what was the date that Mitchell Hedges was in New Orleans in 13?
It is 1913. It was October 1913 that he was working in a restaurant in New Orleans.
Well, at the very same time, Ambrose Bierce was in New Orleans. Mitchell Hedges goes across the border, and he gets captured by Pancho Villa. Ambrose Bierce goes across the border and goes to work for
Both in November 1913.
Now, there's some strange sort of link-up here, where you've got somebody who, like Ambrose Bierce, who is America's foremost occultist, and you've got somebody on the trail of going into that part of the world, obviously to, I think in Mitchell Hedges' terms, to go on an adventure and to look for ancient civilizations, the origins of Atlantis. But the strangeness is that Ambrose Bierce disappears, and Mitchell Hedges never ever mentions Ambrose Bierce in any of his letters from what I have seen. And that, where you would have two people of non-Mexican origin working within the camp of Pancho Villa, wouldn't actually not have met each other.
Not even just the camp of Pancho Villa, but Mitchell Hedges must have had some sort of knowledge of the people at Hearst Newspapers, because he struck up a very good working relationship with them further on in his career. And Ambrose Bierce worked for the Hearst Newspapers.
Yeah, it's the non-mentioning, I think, is the intriguing part, that they tend not to want to talk about each other, as if both of them couldn't actually say that they actually knew each other.
And it's a very interesting aspect to Danger My Ally, because in the 1920s there were books written just about what happened to Ambrose Bierce, and Danger My Ally would almost have been a success story as an international bestseller, if you want, if he had actually had said, oh, actually, I was with Ambrose Bierce at the time of his disappearance. Just that inclusion would have made it much more intriguing, but he never did.
So Sibley Morell may have it right when he explains that they were sworn to secrecy because of what they were doing.
There's the other aspect in it as well, that perhaps something very macabre happened to Ambrose Bierce, of which Mitchell Hedges didn't want to be associated with. You know, he didn't want to be drawn in to the debate of somebody disappearing or be associated with it.
That's one aspect, and actually when you read Frank Dolan's Holy Eyes, you then find out that Sibley Morell is very much like the two of you. He knew Anna Mitchell Hedges personally and started to, I think, dig deeper and come up with that book, which I felt was pretty bizarre until, once again, Chris, you said, well, perhaps the answers to the bizarreness lie in a novel, The White Tiger. Please explain, because it's probably the twist in the tale of the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull enigma.
Perhaps the only way that Mitchell Hedges could possibly reveal a hidden, weighty secret in his life that he couldn't tell anybody about, but he had to get it off his chest, that if he wrote it in some form of code or in one of his books. I mean, I read White Tiger when I was staying with Anna, but it didn't actually hit me then. But then when I read it again, things started to fall into place. And the very fact that he devotes two chapters of being drawn into this place where he's been taken through esoteric rites and then taken by this lost tribe into the underground caverns of their city or whatever it is, where mysteriously stones weighing several tons are mysteriously levitated away, to which he said that these people must have had the knowledge of anti-gravity. And then to be shown this magnificent treasure, which he calls the treasure of Montezuma, and then describes the treasure. But the interesting thing, he doesn't say there are lots of stones and diamonds and rubies, but he talks a lot of things like jadeite, pendants, and then his flooring statement, he says, and crystal heads. Now that to me just hit me straight in the face. You know, he's actually telling you of what possibly happened to him whilst he was in Mexico. Perhaps not in its entirety, but certainly in its outline sketching.
And just to drive home the point, that novel was published
1931. Yeah.
The Sotheby's auction occurred in 1943.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the publishing date, okay? That's not the writing date.
Do we know?
That's when everything was finished and ready to go. So it was written sometime before that.
That's right.
Do we have any indication when he might have written it?
Probably with a few years previous to that.
Jim, was it Jane Harvey Houston who was his secretary at that time?
Yes, it would have been Jane, yeah.
1931, what you read in this novel is a very bizarre story of pretty much an Englishman who goes in search of danger in the Middle America, gets initiated and becomes the head of a local tribe. Do you think this might have been an autobiography? Might Mitchell Hedges actually have become the head of a local tribe?
Wherever he went, like when he was in Lubantun, and in Central America, they kind of looked at him as a bit of a god, somebody who had, I don't mean he had powers, but he had the ways to bring things into, to help them, to bring medicines in, to bring food in. So they kind of looked at him as a bit of a god. But even Jane Harvey Houston, in her book, calls him my chief. She always refers to him as my chief, as a sort of a form of adoration, a form of status symbol, you know. He assumes that sort of role, and he certainly does in the book, White Tiger.
In Danger, My Ally, there's also a reference, I think, whereby he goes to a tribe which had never seen any contact with white people and were very hostile to us foreigners as such, but somehow he was able to befriend them and was given the chief fetish as a thank you for the good he did to the tribe. So do we think that he was given this skull as a thank you? Are there other examples out there of other people who've been doing this? Or
I would think if that had been the case, he would have easily been able to talk about it. No, he had to have come up with it, more of something that he can't talk about.
I think Jim's hitting the nail on the head. It's like we see something that is beyond our understanding, and yet we understand it. And perhaps we have something which is part of that understanding, but we just don't know how to talk about it, because our society would go into that situation if we told anybody about it and either claim it as its own or rubbish it or loot it. And I think Mitchell Hedges was in a real dilemma as to what to do with it, with what he knew. And this is what I mean. He seems to broach that subject in White Tiger. He's skipping around it. He's letting you know that something happened to him, and he really doesn't know how to deal with it.
If you know anything else about Mitchell Hedges, you can almost put names on everybody that he mentions in there.
When you actually see the British Museum skull, and you see the Paris skull and the Smithsonian skull, and the Mitchell Hedges one, I mean, there is no comparison artistically between the Mitchell Hedges one or any of the others.
It is in a league of its own, isn't it?
Totally.
If we take White Tiger as fact, disguised as fiction, how do you think Mitchell Hedges came into this possession? Okay, he's seen this in this cave as part of this treasure of Montezuma. How did it end up in his possession and travel around the world with him?
That was his dilemma. There is saying, did he plant it in Lubantun for Anna to find it as part of giving him the skull of provenance? Well, that's only Anna's story. Certainly, if you have an artifact and you want to give it provenance, then I think...
Put it in an auction.
Either give it to somebody you know and say, look, will you keep this for me and give me some money for it as a loan and I'll pay you back. And if I don't pay you back, then you can put it in for auction, which is what possibly happened. I don't know. But certainly in 1943, without a question, Mitchell Hedges has got the crystal skull of provenance. But he does say in his book, I have reasons for not telling. So that's a sort of like a paradox there. One that we can find out, yes, we do know where it came from, then why not tell us? But you're saying that you won't tell us, which is indicating there's something behind the auction that you want us to go and look for. It's a psychological clue. He's telling you to go and look for something. He can't tell you because he wants you to find it for yourself. He's in a dilemma.
It was Mitchell Hedges' task in life to inspire people to go on and have adventures.
Yes.
So by leaving mysteries, what are you inspiring them to do?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an extremely good point. If you want somebody to have an adventure...
One of the things which I noted when I was confronted with that possibility was that he wasn't alone. There were other people who went into that forest, and some people went with different motives. I remember one of the people who went in search of the mushroom cult spoke to a local tribe who still worshipped the mushroom, then wrote a book about it, pretty much gave everything pseudonyms, but equally soon, the entire facade dropped and the real people were identified. And all of a sudden, hundreds of people came to this village.
Right.
More scientists came. And the woman who the village had identified as the chief spokesman, her life was destroyed. She was singularly blamed for all the ill which fell on the village, even though she had just been, you know, put forward. She didn't invite it herself. She was locked up. She was arrested. But the end of the story was that us white men got the answer to a story, but actually we killed it as well, because the mushroom cult in the village no longer happened. She said that the gods, the mushroom cult as a ritual, no longer worked. And literally, we had to destroy the entire village. And I think that's also something which Mitchell Hedges was extremely wary about and knowledgeable of, that if he brought it in a certain way, it could lead to tremendous difficulties for, I think, a people who he had extreme affection for and definitely didn't want to see any harm come to.
Very much so,
In the same way that if Mitchell Hedges came across the same sort of thing of people, a tribe who had a secret, showed him the secret, he would have known that same story, that if he had told everybody about it, he would destroy the people who are the guardians. And it would have destroyed him too. You know, the world would come crashing down on this guardianship. And really, part of the guardianship is that you are to guard something without telling anybody where it came from.
So maybe it's easier then to make up a story about it so you don't have, so that people stop asking.
Exactly. The one way you unburden yourself is to write a fictitious story which is actually full of metaphors and clues. And I think it was you, Philip, that said if we could look at the book again, White Tiger, and find out who are all the characters and who are the characters in real life. I think we were actually talking sometime, who's Pancho Villa and who's Ambrose Bierce and who's Mitchell Hedges and what part of the women. I mean, certainly the two women in the book play the parts of, certainly one is his wife, but I don't know who the other one. Possibly it could have been Jean Harlow, actually. I have a feeling it may have been. But I wouldn't like to put my hand on my heart and say that.
Have you got any suspicions, Jim?
None that I'm ready to reveal at this point in time.
Oh.
It sounds as if you could be the son of Mitchell Hedges.
Yeah, so I do have to admit that myself and a good friend of mine, as opposed to myself, has been doing research on this since I introduced her to Anna back in 1995, 1994. She's a very good genealogical researcher, and she's come up with all kinds of interesting clues lately.
To be continued. Now, there are some people, the skeptics, who argue that Mike Mitchell Hedges wasn't a real archaeologist, that he never did anything worthwhile to archaeology in his entire life, that he looted, that he used dynamite, and that he pretty much traveled the world on the paycheck of rich women whom he abused, to some extent, extracted money from.
A guy called Norman Hammond, who is referring to Mitchell Hedges as a Sunday afternoon looter. And then he says there's a well-known photograph, he says a photograph of Mitchell Hedges with Lady Lamont Brown sitting on a pyramid, and they've just blown up the top of the pyramid with dynamite to see if there was a tomb inside, and of course there wasn't. Now, if you look at the photograph, it's Mitchell Hedges got a beard, Lady Richmond Brown sitting next door, and there's somebody else, isn't there? They've actually airbrushed Thomas Gann out of the photograph. If you look very carefully, you could just make out a shadow. But looking at it, looking back into the thing, it's actually Thomas Gann was the person who apparently did use dynamite. I'm not saying at Lubantun, but he did use it. There's an insinuation that Mitchell Hedges went for aristocratic people with money.
I want to just make note here of a few items directly related to the people that Mr. Mitchell Hedges was representing when he was on those sites, okay? This first one comes from a book titled The Report on the Investigations at Lubantun, British Honduras in 1926 by T.A. Joyce. T.A. Joyce joined Mr. Mitchell Hedges and Lady Richmond Brown over there in 1926, and in his book, I quote, "In conclusion, I must express my great indebtedness to Lady Richmond Brown and Mr. Mitchell Hedges, the kindliest of fellow travelers and most helpful of collaborators." I have another one here from the British Museum, which says, "Dear Mr. Mitchell Hedges, the specimens which you have submitted to the British Museum, being the results of your recent excavations in the Bay Islands, have been carefully examined. It is my opinion that they represent a very early type of Central American culture, probably pre-Maya. The fact that they appear to bear relations with the pre-conquest civilizations of Costa Rica, early Maya, and archaic Mexico suggests that this is an early center from which various forms of culture were diffused over Central America, element of the American Aboriginal civilization. The trustees of the museum have granted me leave to make a journey to inspect the site next year. In conclusion, I would like to add that I consider that your discovery is of great importance. Yours very truly, T.A. Joyce." One more. This is 1930. "Dear Mr. Mitchell Hedges, I am glad to hear that you are proposing to make another journey of exploration in Central America, this time, as I understand, to an area in the territory of Honduras, where you have already found interesting archaeological material. I have been in communication with Mr. George Hay, the founder and director of the Museum of the American Indian in New York, and I understand that while you are conducting the expedition at your own expense, or with funds collected by yourself, you would like to have the moral support and approval of the British Museum and the Museum of the American Indian, and propose to divide the finds resulting from your expedition between these two institutions. So far as the British Museum is concerned, I can, on behalf of the trustees, authorize you to say that your expedition to Honduras has their full approval. The museum has benefited in the past by your previous expeditions in respect both of objects presented, of concessions for exploration obtained and handed over, and of information given. All of these have been gratuitously placed at the disposal of the museum, and we shall await with interest the results of your new explorations. Yours sincerely, F.J. Kenyon, Director and Principal Librarian of the British Museum." He was earning his own money to pay for these expeditions and turning everything he found over to the museums. Museums would kill to have that kind of people. One note I would like to make, that little note about the referring to Mrs. Lady Richmond Brown as his bankroll, and this comes from Mitchell Hedges' poetry, and this was written for Lady Richmond Brown. "We shall forget the cream of sun-kissed beach and all the secrets that the tropics teach, and that we learned and shared each one with each, the while we lived and loved completely there. Together we crossed 1,000 miles of sea. You came to the land of pines and winds with me. Now you go back alone, untrammeled, free. Will you not miss me sometimes in your dreams? Will you forget how? Come. Be quick, sweetheart, I must not stay. I feel a stinging smart behind my eyes, and we have got to part. So let us do it quickly, little one. Goodbye, my dear, we shall not meet again. You've been divine to me, you were the rain to my parched heart and life. So like the stain of sunset in the west, the past shall die. Goodbye, my love of the long-lashed eyes. Goodbye."
And if only all of us could speak to our bank manager like that.
Exactly. She was definitely the love of his life. There's no doubt about that. I mean, and you can find that in all the documents in the British archives there about the divorce and all of her divorce and things like that. I'm wondering if the Smithsonian might have put picture films up to this to further discredit Mitchell Hedges' reputation before somebody has the gall and the curiosity enough to approach them with their findings, Endanger My Ally, in the comparison of the two letters that I had published in there. One was in the original Endanger My Ally, printed in England, and it was from George C. High at the Hay Foundation, the Museum of American Indian, Hay Foundation, New York. And the other one was a new one we obtained in 1995 from the Museum of the American Indian, now under the watchful eye of the Smithsonian Institution. In the first one, it clearly states a thank you to Mr. Mitchell Hedges for the donation of more than 3,000 objects. The one that we obtained from the Smithsonian Institution acknowledges his donation of some almost 800 objects. So what I would really like to know is, what's happened to the other 2,200 objects?
That's an awful lot of objects. Coming back to the role of Anna, and pretty much coming back to the role of her father, what we're saying is he didn't want to reveal. Anna actually was given the rough cut of this object because she was young when she got the object and she had to take care of it for the rest of her life, which was fortunate in the sense that she, you know, she grew very old, but it also meant a very long period of time in changing times. The media became interested in it. The profile of this girl became much more important. And I think the fact that her father could just get away with saying, I've got reasons for not revealing, full stop. She couldn't get that, and she had to come up with a convenient lie, which...
That's my feelings exactly.
Which was the Lubantum 1924 story. Do we think we actually have to look in towards Lubantum? Do we think that is the general area where it might have been discovered, or might it actually been somewhere completely different in anything south of, say, Mexico City?
I've often thought, why did Mitchell Hedges, out of the whole of Central America, go for Lubantum? Why did he choose that particular spot?
That's a very interesting point, because Lubantum is very different than all the other places. They claim it's more of Incan construction than actual Mayan and Aztec, just because the way the stones are put together. So is it that much older than all the rest of the places? I don't know. But there's definitely something different about it. I do know some stories about it that just kind of turned on a little light in my head that I should probably not say anything about.
I mean, you've been there. How many times, Jim?
Just once. Just right. Once in 1996.
And have you traveled to other places in Mexico?
A few of the places north of there. And when we were there at Lubantum, I mean, we checked out every other ruin that we passed on our way down there and back towards San Ignacio and over to Tikal. And there was nothing like Lubantum.
So it has a feel all of its own.
Yeah, most certainly. Mm-hmm. There's one little point I would really like to clarify before it gets really taken out of context. I'm actually afraid that it already has to a point. And so I got to make it as well known as possible. Recently, David Hatcher Childress sent me a new printing of his book that him and Stephen Mailer did on the crystal skulls. And unfortunately, they put that point in here that I knew was going to come up eventually. I want everybody to know that Anna had absolutely nothing to do with it. They say in page 221 of their book that Anna Mitchell Hedges herself may have engaged in a deliberate fraud that can now be exposed. She had her father's autobiography republished in 1995. As mentioned in this American version, it's not American, it's Canadian, Anna had added a picture of the crystal skull with the caption that she found it on her 17th birthday. Mitchell Hedges himself never stated such a thing. Between pages 96 and 97, another photo was added with a caption that claims that the girl in the picture is Anna Mitchell Hedges at age 11 and a half with a Mayan boy with hookworm. That's the problem right there. I first encountered that picture in the Skull Speaks book, which had been published, I believe, in the late 1980s. And it was this picture of a little girl sitting holding a little Mayan boy with hookworm. And they had said that it was a picture of Anna Mitchell Hedges. Being that it was the only picture anybody ever had anywhere of a young Anna, and I think there's also reasons why pictures... I think I have a good idea why pictures don't exist of her. I took that picture when we were printing Danger, My Ally, and I put it in there without Anna knowing about it. So in no way was she attempting to perpetrate any sort of fraud by doing so, because she had no idea that I was putting it in there. I put it in there thinking she'd be happy to pass on the fact that, yes, here's a picture of her. Well, she was actually quite angry with me for putting it in there when she found it in the final printing, which made me a little curious. And then when we brought, after our trip down to Lubantum with her, she financed bringing Leonardo Acal up to help raise money for the school that he wanted to build down there. And part of the presentation that I had put together had that photo inserted in the slideshow. When we were previewing it and she saw it there, she got very angry and said, that is not going to be in the presentation. And again, I argued with her, feeling it was just her being shy, not wanting to show herself. Leonardo later explained to me, he says, you know why she doesn't want that in there? She says, it's because it's not her. And he actually knew who the lady was, or at least she was a lady now, in that photo. for the longest while, I was kind of a little angry at Anna about that because I felt I'd kind of been betrayed because she never actually came out and said it wasn't her, although she never really came out and said it was. So several years later, I had a conversation with Brian Hadley James, the author of The Skull Speaks, and I just happened to bring that point up. And Brian said to me, he says, well, he says, I kind of have to take a lot of responsibility for that, he says, because we were really looking, trying to find a picture of Anna in Belize in those days, and that was the closest thing we could come up with. And we didn't know it was Anna, we didn't know it wasn't Anna. So they put it in, okay? So when people begin to write in their books that Anna purposely put this thing in there to build up her story, I just want to make sure that everybody realizes she had nothing to do with that.
And that is noted.
Now, as far as pictures go, I believe there's no pictures of Anna because Mr. Mitchell Hedges didn't want one to accidentally fall into the hands of his wife back in England, where she would have to come out and say, who's that little girl?
Doesn't she look remarkably like you?
Sorry, can I just stay on that idea of the picture? In Jane's book, Blue Blaze, the pictures in her book, she donates quite a few paragraphs to people having hookworm in one of the places they visited. And that picture goes side by side with that description.
Tying it back to Mitchell Hatch's Ambrose Bierce, there's references in Danger My Ally that he was definitely courted by the British intelligence service to spy on Trotsky after the Russian Revolution.
Sorry, Phil. I have a question for you there. How did they know he was living with Trotsky?
Exactly. He also says that he turned it down, yet at the same time, I believe it's quite well established that his whereabouts for the next few months are less than sketchy. We don't really know where he was at that time. When I was reading the sections of Danger My Ally about how he actually goes to Mexico, it's standard textbook intelligence for how an intelligence operative has to go to a foreign country. Do you guys think that Mike Mitchell Hatches might have been in the employ of her King's Secret Service, I believe that it was then called at the time, in 1913?
I wouldn't say he was, this is my personal feeling, I wouldn't say he was necessarily directly employed. I would say he definitely had connections. There was people in the know that he knew. My feeling of it all is that he said to them, listen, this is what I'm doing. Anything you want me to look for while I'm there?
There was a very good reason for sending operatives into Mexico because it was just coming up prior to the Second World War when the Germans and the Japanese were making big noises in that part of the world to secure oil supplies. We all know that if there's not an oil supply to a country, any war that it wages cannot happen. If they were to go in, that is possibly what their cover was to find. But I think there were other things happening along the way.
One of the enigmas which, as I said, several books have been talking about Ambrose Bierce. Do we think that his disappearance has got anything directly related to the Crystal Skull?
That could be part of the answer to that question. How it came to be in my possession, I have reason for not revealing.
I mean, I can only suppose something or assume something, but just looking at the Ambrose Bierce personality, and if you do a sort of a character profile of him, what would he... He was quite in his senior years when he was in 1913. There was one suggestion that he had gone back to Europe to go and fight in the First World War to help. But who is going to take somebody of that age to go and help them fight a war, to be quite honest? Personally, I think Ambrose Bierce had come to the pinnacle of his life. He disappeared into Mexico with a huge sum of money on him, possibly to go and to do work that he was being asked to do, but along the way he was doing work for himself. And because he was so linked up into the occult sciences, if he had come across a tribe of people who he really related to and then decided to not to resurface, he either disappeared or he died in some form of attempt, and of which Mitchell Hedges possibly was there at the time, and he really didn't want, if he would, he would have to say, look, I was there, this is what happened, and he'd rather not say where he was and what happened. which indicates why there's no mention of Ambrose Bierce in any of his writings. But if Ambrose Bierce had found, basically, in his life, what I would call the Grail Cup, or the treasure, or the thing that he really was the pinnacle of his life, he would have stayed where he was. And there is some indication, somebody has actually written, that had he gone, I think he was put in such a way, if Ambrose Bierce had gone to the other side, and he found what he was looking for, he wouldn't come back. He would stay there. I mean, that's a bit bizarre to say all that. But if you look at somebody, you know, it's like you find your holy grail, you stay where you are. You don't come back.
Him being there does give an entire different dimension to what I quite often refer to as the skeptics try to reduce it to, a very one-sided debate, you know, how that Mitchell Hedges just acquired it at auction in 1943. It doesn't explain anything because it's just one aspect of a larger story. That is about the historical record, the historical discovery of how this artifact came about. The next question then, I think, is very much open-ended, and it's about personal experiences of two people who have been around the skull a number of times over a number of years. If the skull is a genuine artifact from an old civilization, is it just a ritual object, and should we just see it as an art object, or is it actually something much more? Is it very much in the same ballpark as the psychic people who have been interfacing with the object are saying?
When I was on the island of Bimini in 1990, I had just seen Sammy, Anna Mitchell Hedges, and she had a magazine on her table. It said Atlantis Revisited, and it was about a trip of a group of people going to Bimini, and it was to happen in about 3 weeks' time. I immediately got in touch with the people and left Anna, said thank you, got in touch, and I flew to Miami, went out to Bimini, and I met up with these people. Whilst on the island of Bimini, something happened. There was like something resurfaced inside my consciousness, so to speak. And that led me to understand the myth, you might say, of not just one skull, but many skulls. And they are acting like a holographic memory. If you put them together in a certain configuration and you activate them in a certain configuration, they actually throw up what you call a magnetic field. Now, it's that you have to immerse yourself in that magnetic field, in that sort of hologram. And by doing that, you are fed, you become part of that consciousness. So any question you ask is answered. It is art, because the skull represents mind, if you like to put it in that way. It has a face, so the face is always facing to the zero point. And then every time you click it to the left or to the right, it goes through the configurations of 1 to 11, and then back up to zero at the top. What I'm saying by this is that the art is, it shows you where each skull has to face. It's a metaphor that it is containing of mind, but only part of mind. And if you put it in a configuration and activate it, and the secret is how you activate it.
And that's where obviously the ritual of several Mayan people come in, because I'm quite intrigued that at this present moment in time, the Mayan people seem to have living legends and living ceremonies which involve crystal skulls, which actually predate the Western hype, so to speak. So where is the adventure of the crystal skull taking us?
Well, if we knew that, we wouldn't have to look.
But like any explorer, we need to have an indication of direction.
It's definitely taking us forward. It's definitely come out into the open in a very large way over the last couple of months, and has brought in thousands, if not millions, of more curious people to start looking. It could be the start of some whole shift of some sort. The little things have done that in the past. You can very easily see it happening again in the future. Hopefully it's a good shift. I would think it would be. Anything that gets people investigating and looking more into what's going on around them is always useful.
I think Jim said the nail on the head. He's used the word curious, which is exactly, I mean, some people just think it's a great film. Other people think it's pretty boring. But other people think, oh, there's something in this, I must look into it. So they start investigating it, they go around, they look at the Mitchell Hedges website, they look at other things that are going on in the world and think, there's something more into this. They then start look at the Mayan prophecy, the 2012, the 13 skulls, they think, well, wait a minute, there is something in this.
I don't think George has the slightest idea how close he's actually come to the truth.
Yeah, he did actually say in one interview, I think he said that out of the four films he made to do with Indiana Jones, that this one was the one that was the most easiest to make because it struck at a chord which was quite... Sorry, the underlying truth of the film was based on fact, on mythical fact.
Okay, then I want to know where he found this out from. In the movie, Indiana Jones makes the comment that the aliens helped the Mayans with their agriculture. Back in not too long after Anna moved back to England, around 97, 98, we took Carol Wilson, my older brother and I took Carol Wilson over to the British Museum to meet Dr. Graham. Dr. Elizabeth Graham has spent lots of time at doing archaeological works down in Belize, was very well acquainted with Anna and the Mitchell Hedges story. We went over and met her at the Royal Ontario Museum, and she was more than happy to take us into the back rooms and show us all the artifacts that nobody gets to see. And one of the very first artifacts she showed us was it was a statue of a crippled little fellow, kind of sitting hunched over. She says they don't know anything about them except for the fact that they seem to have been revered by the people and taken good care of. And they had called them the Hunchbacks. Well, at that point, Carol just kind of nudged me and said under her breath, she says, that's what you get when you cross an alien with a human. And then she came out and said to Dr. Graham, they were a very frail people, but extremely intelligent. And the other people took good care of them because they told them when to plant their crops and when to harvest their crops and all of this other stuff about their agriculture.
Interesting you should say that's what you get when you cross an alien with a human, because the hunchback is if you take something that's quite tall with something that's quite short, mm-hmm. it might grow into a hunchback because the spine is elongated. You might get a long spine and a short body. So hunchbacks.
I think on that note, we need to conclude the interview, and it'll rally people's minds to pick that one up and interpret it. And it's actually also the point where the movie of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull ends. So I would like to thank both of you for a riveting exploration into something which only people like yourselves who knew Anna for a very long time and who've been really digging into the story of the Crystal Skull would not only have been able to pick up, but actually have been working on. And Jim, I hope that at one point you will not become Mitchell Hedges, but will actually turn into an oracle who reveals all.
I'll do my best.
Thank you, Chris and Jim.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Steve.
So.
Thank you.